Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists, ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Therapy Chat Podcast, episode 527.
This is the Therapy Chat Podcast with Laura Reagan, LCSWC. The information shared in this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. And now, here's your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm so thrilled to be bringing you a new conversation with my dear friend and respected colleague, Linda Tai. You have heard Linda on Therapy Chat before. She's a therapist, speaker, teacher, leader. She's a very thought-provoking person, and I love listening to her speak. In our conversation today, we're talking about a decolonized perspective on attachment theory. And this is something that all of us therapists and people who are curious about attachment theory can really ponder. It's a very expansive perspective. So let's get right into my conversation with Linda Tai. Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and I'm so happy to be back together with my friend and very respected colleague, Linda Tai. Linda, thank you so much for coming back to Therapy Chat today.
It is such a gift to be back here with you and with your listeners.
Oh, thank you. Always being with you feels so nurturing and beautiful to my heart. And that's what other people say about you as well. The people that I talk to when they interact with your work, they're like, Linda, her work, oh my gosh. She's just like a warm hug.
That has been a lifetime of work to get to this point. And you know what? I think there can be no greater gift in life than to love each other into becoming. And there are so many people who've loved me into becoming. And so I hope to pass that on through who I turn up to be, in the world.
Yeah. Well, it's felt. And I feel appreciation for that right now. And I know by the time we finish talking, I'll be probably just feeling giddy because that's how it always ends up. So today we're going to be talking about something that I've wanted to ask you about on the podcast for a while, which is your perspective on a decolonized approach to attachment theory. So I really want to invite you, we can have a really deep conversation about that. But before we get into talking about that fascinating topic, in my opinion, will you just tell our listeners a little bit more about who you are, what you do?
Sure. So I'm a former child refugee. I was born in Vietnam and raised in Australia. And as an adult, I became an immigrant into the United States, into Alaska specifically. And refugitude, displacement has actually been a theme that's woven its way through my life as a result of that initial displacement. And I often think of refugees as, look, home ceased to exist long before we actually left, and there was no home to go back to. And so people who flee childhood trauma or flee homes where there's domestic violence or flee homes where there's addiction or flee parts of the country that aren't supportive of their gender identity or sexual orientation are also refugees, right? Home ceased to exist long before you actually left, and there's no home to go back to. And we become refugees from a land called the body. And it was in Alaska that I actually got to do the work of reclaiming what it means to have a body and be in a body, because living in interior Alaska, we're hunting, we're fishing, I'm using power tools, I'm measuring in feet and inches. Like, who does that? Right? When you have the exceptionally commonsensical metric system to work off of.
I was going to say, well, yeah, Americans, basically.
Yes. And so there was the measure twice, cut once. There was the check the weather before you go outside because you want to have the right clothes on. And then you go outside with the right clothes on and you actually do that for a little while close to home to make sure that you've got the right clothes on. Yeah, and then I'm shoveling gravel, I'm pushing wheelbarrows, I'm engaging with my body. And that allowed me to develop a secure attachment relationship with my body. I got to come home to my body. I was no longer a refugee from a land called the body. And this took 10 years. I took 10 years of addiction recovery and trauma recovery, but prior to that, just living in Alaska. And from there, I then taught meditation and yoga into addiction recovery, trauma recovery, then trained as a mental health clinician, as a social worker. And before I went to graduate school, I knew I wanted to be a trauma therapist. So I got all the trainings. I'd read The Body Keeps a Score in 2014, got it on the day it came out. And the first half of the book helped me make sense of myself and my life. And the second half of the book gave me a path forward. And so by the time I finished graduate school, I was trained in IFS and brain spotting and sensory-motor psychotherapy and havening touch. And that meant that I could really hit the ground running. And I also got to do my own deep personal work through those modalities, as well as through Pesso Boyden system psychomotor, which is where you get to give yourself a secure attachment imprint through giving yourself ideal parents. And so I'd done all of this personal work along the way to becoming a somatic therapist and a trauma therapist who now lives and works on the lands of the Dene Athabascan peoples of the Middle Tanana Valley, where I work at the intersection of addiction and trauma, at the confluence of the longitudinal impacts of mass historical trauma of colonization, and where that then emerges across many generations. And there's also many Americans, many United Statesians who moved to Alaska to get away from the United States, to get away as far away as possible from Yep. their homes. And so it feels like such a gift. It feels like such a gift to have my life make sense in hindsight in this way. And yet, you know, traditional attachment theory and what I learned in graduate school about trauma and what I read in The Body Keeps a Score about trauma was part of the story but wasn't the entire story. And hence giving rise to a body of work that weaves together the work of many other BIPOC scholars and individuals is something that's well known amongst those of us who are part of collectivistic cultures, who are part of land-based cultures, where there's a more expansive conceptualization of what it means to be human and what it means to be securely attached.
Mm-hmm. Just letting that land. You said a lot there.
I did say a lot.
Yeah. You mentioned where you live and practice now as you practice where you live, because I know you're traveling around a lot too. But you mentioned the impact of colonization, and you also mentioned addiction and intergenerational trauma. So I don't want to seem too simplistic here, but I do think that there are a lot of people listening who may not really be very well aware of the peoples of Alaska, the people who live there now. And would you just say a little bit about that? I know it might seem strange, but even people in the United States don't know a lot about that.
Yeah, there are over 30 distinct tribes and nations here in Alaska. And I think one of the things that colonization does is it lumps an entire group of people together into a monolith. Right? You look at all the countries of Europe and a French person gets upset when you call them European, right? Yeah. And why is it that these huge land masses of Australia and the United States and Canada are considered like, you know, a monolith when it comes to the indigenous peoples of the place, when there are hundreds, like well over 1,000, right? It's very unique cultures and languages and traditions and ways of being. And here in Alaska, modernity colonization came to Alaska rather late compared to the rest of the world due to the harshness of the climate and the territories here. What that also means is that the current generation of elders went through boarding schools, went through residential schools. So it's not part of history. It's living history. It's alive. Yeah. And what that also means is that there's a legacy and a burden placed upon elders to pass on cultural inheritance and cultural wisdom, while also contrasted or juxtaposed or deeply anguished by the fact that they were extremely punished for practicing their culture and being who they are and speaking their languages. Yeah.
Abused and basically tortured.
Yes.
In the boarding schools.
Yes. Yes. And so when it comes to residential addiction treatment here in Alaska, I spent the first 10 years of my career working in addiction recovery and addiction treatment, whether it was intensive outpatient, residential or community-based addiction or recovery settings. I saw over and over again that when it came to the Alaska Native community population individuals, that our Western trauma treatment modalities, they just weren't working. Right, they just weren't working. And you'd see the revolving door, but there wouldn't be questions or follow-ups. There wouldn't really be evaluation processes in terms of what worked. And what I actually got to see was the more I brought of myself and my own cultural identity into the space, the more my Alaska Native clients were willing to turn up with aspects of their own cultural identity. And a returning to culture and a reclamation of culture was actually what, in all the cases that I saw, that I worked with personally, that I actually worked adjacent to, that reclamation of identity was part of the path to sobriety. And it was a huge part of that path to sobriety. And I look at modernity in the United States, and we don't have emotional sobriety, like as a culture, as a collective. And I feel that we've lost our way in many ways in terms of who we are and where we've come from and the anchoring of those cultural traditions. Yeah. And it's more than culture, right? It's also about relationship to land. But I'll just pause and take a breath with you, because I just noticed you took a big, deep breath in.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for the noticing my breath. And, you know, I was really taking in what you were saying. I was just really listening. But also when you said we've lost our way, I mean, gosh, that's apparent in many ways, isn't it? I mean, you know, micro and macro levels, but the whole idea of Americanism and this melting pot and whiteness is about erasing culture, right? So, you know, as you said, like the more than 1,000 different cultures become a group of other, and that's convenient. It's, you know, it's not just convenient. It's a intentional process of erasure.
Of erasure, yeah. Demonizing and dehumanizing.
Exactly. So that's just like, it's heavy.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, there's a scholar by the name of Vanessa Andreotti, and she's written a book called Hospicing Modernity. And I was listening to one of her podcasts, and in it she was talking about a visit to the Indigenous elders of Central America and South America. And she asks them, do you consider yourselves to be collectivistic or individualistic? And she describes what each of those words mean. And these Indigenous elders then start talking with and amongst each other. And then they turned around to her and they said, we don't consider ourselves either. And she looks at them and they described how they considered themselves. And what they said was that individualism and collectivism are both notions that are anthropocentric, meaning that they center humans.
Mm.
And they center humans at the center of the web of creation and of life itself. And they described how they saw themselves. And Dr. Andreotti gave the phrase metabolistic. They consider themselves to be metabolistic, part of a larger metabiome and microbiome. Right? They're part of a larger web that is metabolistic, meaning that within the cycles of creation and maintenance and destruction and decay is fecundity that gives rise to new growth that then, yeah, and so that metabolistic nature is a fecund system within which all is provided and there is no waste. I mean, we create so much waste. We create so much pain. When you don't take care of your pain, you become a pain for someone else. When you take care of your grief, you cause grief for others. When you don't take care of your own waste, then you need other people to take care of yours or to become the vessels for your shadow.
I did not think you were going to say shadow. And I'm picking up what you're putting down. Feels so true what you're saying, and feels so true. I just, you know, and I want to pause, even though I'm hanging on your every word, I want to pause again just to give people a chance to like sit with what they just heard. Because I mean, this is like, ooh, you know, like it's not only that there's a heaviness to the time and space that we're in and what we've made that is happening now. In other words, modernity. But also, it's just like conceptually dense and also so counter to a Western way of thinking, what you shared about metabolizing and the web of creation. And yeah, it's like, I love that when you said they decenter it, their perspective, the Indigenous elders that were being interviewed, their perspective on are we individualistic or collectivist is like, we're just part of this whole, we're not the middle of it. We're not, it's not revolving around us.
Yeah. Yeah. And so all land-based cultures are by necessity collectivistic, but not all collectivistic cultures are land-based. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. And there are some cultures that have more individualistic traits who are also land-based, and others that, right, and they also have the collectivistic traits, like there's a balance and a harmony there. Right, so there's a dynamic polarity rather than polarization, because where there's polarization, that's an indication of trauma. And so the dynamic polarities that can exist within a system that is deeply metabolistic, where there is no waste, and the waste creates a fecundity of fuel. You know, the most fecund place is the forest floor. That humus layer of decay is where the fecundity is.
I know the word, and I know what you're talking about with the forest floor, but I know I may not be the only one who's like, what do we need to know about the fecundity? Because it feels important. And it's like such a word that we don't normally talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Will you expand upon the fecundity
Absolutely.
For a moment?
And there may be some, there may be some censorship here.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Moist, warm, cauldron of all creation.
Okay.
Yeah, there is so much dynamic potential that is there if we can be patient enough to allow that which needs to decay to decay and rest. And then from that emptiness springs new life. That void, yeah, the void of, it's the paradox, and yet it's also the dynamic polarity, right? The void and the emptiness of fecundity. Yeah, that fecundity contains both this void and this emptiness. It's the container, it's the cauldron, and it contains all the nutrients when the timing is right.
Yeah. So that idea of like the decay process is not something to be disgusted by, or it's an important part of the cycle. Of course, we in the West are very death averse.
Yes. And we're very oriented towards maintenance and consumption. And not only are we death averse and death phobic, we're also grief phobic.
Oh, yeah.
And feelings phobic. And yet grief is the great metabolizer, right? You know, when someone actually begins to feel their feelings in real time, particularly the emotion of grief, if they're able to let their grief be moved through, expressed and witnessed in real time, I'm writing their discharge summary, like in my head. Yeah, because grief is the great metabolizer. Grief is an alchemical process that creates fuel and nourishment and sustenance for future growth. Grief expands integrative capacity within an organism, within a person. Yeah, it expands your integrative capacity when it comes to a person's ability to metabolize life. And we become stuck in our grief because we don't have the cultural containers and processes by which to move our grief through. Yeah. And if anything, moving the grief through is this container where things can actually settle and land and decompose. And we can actually allow that natural decomposition to happen, the natural letting go. It's part of the rhythms and the cycles of and the seasons of life and human development over the course of a lifespan. As we change jobs and change partners and reconcile the person that we were with the person who we are now, with the person we'd like to become. as we reconcile with the harms that we've caused ourselves, the harms we've caused others, as we reconcile with the world that we were born into, that we deeply, deeply knew that our birthright was something else. Yeah. And this world that has such disequilibrium of resource allocation and such disequilibrium of power, right? There's so much grief in that, as well as sacred outrage. And yet if our grief isn't held, then our sacred outrage ricochets back and forth between entitled rage and impotent rage, righteous rage and helpless rage. And we're then looking to attachment theory, right, to help us deal with the anxieties with which we move through the world, as well as trauma theory, yeah, you know, what we currently recognize as traumatic. And it's not enough. Like, it's not enough to provide a conceptual landscape, because some of us need conceptual landscapes to help us make sense of ourselves and the world. And that makes sense because where there's existential confusion, it's also an indication that there has been existential dread and horror and terror and annihilation energy. Mm. And I know I just said a whole lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. The last sentence, I heard it, but I couldn't take it all in. So I don't know if I just like was deep in thought or went out of my body, one or the other.
Oh, Laura, I'm just going to belch right now because a part of me is feeling rather joyful at having this conversation with you.
Good. Me too.
It's like stuck right here.
A little bouncing.
Yeah. So existential confusion.
Yeah, I think when you mentioned the existential dread, I got lost.
Yeah. Whenever a person has experienced terror, horror, or annihilation energy, whether it's their own or intergenerational or transgenerational, ancestral, or out in the collective field. Yeah. Right. There is so much horror happening in the world. We're getting vicariously exposed to horror and terror. Yeah.
Yeah. We really, really, really are.
There is so much annihilation energy. Yeah. And that implosion, explosion internally that happens, that acute shock trauma that accompanies terror and horror and annihilation energy, elicits a deep existential wound of betrayal and deep confusion. Yeah. I thought I signed up for something else. What is this? What is going on? Like something to the core of me feels like it's splitting apart because I can't possibly contain, witness, participate in, collude in, sit by and do nothing while simultaneously being overwhelmed and shut down in the face of what's happening in the world. Yeah. Without feeling a deep sense of existential confusion.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the need for some sort of conceptual roadmap. Hence the need for someone to say, hey, there's a more expansive conceptualization of secure attachment that's possible and available for us. And this is in no way to denigrate or reduce or minimize what attachment theorists have given to us. It's just that the automaticity with which we look at someone's childhood environment and their parent-child relationships and how they then move interpersonally through the world is becoming reductionistic through the four attachment styles, yeah, and has become reductionistic through the armchair social media discourse.
Very true. Very true.
And it also colludes with and participates in parent blaming, mother blaming specifically within our patriarchal, cisgender, cissexist, ableist, white supremacist society.
I agree with you. And the mother blaming piece is really just not the way.
No, and I'll actually go a step further to say that here in the United States, parents and young families are on purpose under-resourced. On purpose under-resourced. It's a terrible setup. Yeah, and until we begin to look at the macro environment and the longitudinal environment, where I think the ladder's up against the right wall, but it's not quite the entirety of the conversation. Yeah, and I remember, is it okay if I share the story of how I had my moment of attachment theory and everything?
Yeah.
Okay.
Please.
Okay. It was 2020. It was during the pandemic. And I attend the Boston Trauma Conference online. And I got to hear one of the greats in the attachment world speak. And it was Carlyn Lyons-Ruth, who has a lab. She was sharing her study based on thousands of hours of footage. And she tracked mother-child dyads, back then as toddlers, and they did the strange situation test where the mother leaves and the therapist stays with the infant and then the mother returns, right, and we see what the infant does. And she then also did a lot of other video footage of tracking and coding parent-infant relational dynamics. And then she tracked these dyads, particularly the babies, longitudinally, prospectively over time. And she saw that for some of them as teenagers, in their late teens, there was suicidality, addiction, dissociativeness, institutionalization. And then she went backwards, right? She was like, oh, this is what happened to you in your late teenage years. Let's backtrack what happened earlier on. And she looked at those videos. She looked at the coding. And she saw that the biggest contributing factor to what we would call borderline personality disorder symptoms, or rather borderline personality adaptations for an infant that is put into an impossible situation. Yeah, the biggest contributing factor to that was early maternal withdrawal. And she showed a video that she had to play like a few times, slowed down, because none of us caught it the first time around. The mother returns to the room and the infant crawls towards the mother, and the infant gets within a certain proximity and the mother takes a half step back, infant collapses. It was that quick. It was like in certain proximity, half a step back, collapse. Yeah. And then mother goes to pick up the infant, puts the infant down in amidst a bunch of toys and gives the infant toys with which to soothe himself, herself, themselves. And I sat there and I felt into my body this early maternal withdrawal and trying to sense for it in my own body, because I had some really big struggles as in my late teen years and throughout my 20s. And as I felt into my body, the first memory that emerged was being 3 years old, maybe a bit younger than that. My sister was newborn-ish. My parents were sitting, we were sitting in a little apartment, a little flat in Tumut, Australia. We'd just been resettled to Australia, and these really well-meaning people were coming over to give us clothes and food. And they would walk into the apartment, see us there, and then take half a step back. And then they'd put the clothing down or the food down, and then they'd take another half step back, I guess waiting for something, waiting for a response, waiting for us to pick up the food, waiting for something. But I just had viscerally in my body, it was like people taking half a step back from us. And it made me think, what happens to good enough attachment when you are given pervasive messages and messaging and actions of insecurity, threat, or danger towards your body or bodies that look like your body? It made me think about the Vietnam veterans returning from Vietnam who were jeered and booed and spat on and ostracized and vilified and shamed and humiliated by their own peoples. It made me think about the ways in which my black and brown friends have internalized harmful, toxic messages and messaging about people who look like them, who are symbolic representations and extensions of themselves through the media, through the news, that is biased,
yeah,
in a very extreme way. What happens to your good enough relationship with your parents who are doing the best that they could under the circumstances that they had, that given another cultural system, a different society, that your sense of self in the world would be different?
Yeah.
And then it was a few years after that that I came into the work of Dr. Resma Menicum and Dr. Kenneth Hardy, who were two black mental health clinicians. Who spoke depthfully into racialized trauma. And then working with them and with and through their work, I then reconnected to the fullness of what it meant to be me, right? To be a daughter of the confluence of the mighty Mekong River and the South China Sea. What it means to be a daughter. Yeah. What it means to be a daughter of rice paddies and fragrant rice. And what it means to be a daughter of peoples who know how to take care of each other and of the land through song and story and ritual and movement practices and animistic technologies, are peoples who have elders. I mean, where have all the elders gone in modernity? Are peoples who have an expansive conceptualization of our place in the world. We had, I'm still tethered to it. We have a cosmology that gives us our right place through secure attachment to ancestors, to nature, to culture, to bodies, the communal body, the more than human body, and secure attachment to time. Yeah. To a cosmology that gives us a place. And it's interesting because in Peso Boyden system psychomotor, which I studied through Bessel van der Kolk, place is actually the first foundational human need, a place in the womb, a place in someone's body who has a place on this land, who has a place amongst a peoples in a community and a place amongst a peoples in a lineage. And then after we come out of the womb, we have a place in our parents' arms and we have a place in the parental gaze, and our feelings have a place because our parents welcome all parts of us, hopefully, and this then expands into our circle of security, that I can explore and play and be mischievous. I have a place. And modernity
is the product of displacing others. And the need for hierarchy is the need for a place. The need for status is the need for a place. The need for significance and importance. I mean, modernity sells us importance and significance.
Oh, it shouldn't be aspirational to be important, though. I mean, we're
exactly
all important.
Exactly. Yeah.
Therapy Notes is consistently transforming the way therapists manage their practices with continuous updates designed to save money and improve efficiency. Their latest game changer, Therapy Fuel, a powerful and fully integrated suite of AI tools that streamline documentation so you can focus more on your clients. With AI features that help by generating progress notes from summaries or transcriptions, creating contact notes directly from client secure messages, and automated summaries of client history forms, Therapy Notes users are already reporting hours of saved time and energy. Some other recent feature improvements include automated recurring client payments, electronic secondary insurance billing, and their constantly expanding library of outcome measures. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Will you say more about that idea of modernity as the product of the displacement of people?
So Europeans displaced each other before they went around the world displacing Indigenous peoples, genociding Indigenous peoples, genociding the kin of the land, right? The trees and the buffalo and the birds. The United States used to be covered in wild parrots. Covered. You know,
I did not know that.
Yes. There were excerpts of the early explorers who would look at their timepieces and say that 8 whole minutes had passed because the wild parrots had covered the sun for 8 whole minutes. In their traversing across the landscape. Wow. That many that became extinctified due to bounties, due to the need to erase parrots because they would eat the crops that colonizer settlers are bringing with them. The genocide of the North American bison. At one point, one purchaser of bison skeletons at an auction purchased 6 million bison skeletons. Yeah. 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 I mean, what happens to our expansive conceptualization of secure attachment, what it means to be a part of this web of life when our kin become genocided? And this happened in Europe first, right? This happened in Europe first. Yeah. Did you learn about the Great Potato Famine?
Some.
What did you learn was the cause of the Great Potato Famine in Ireland?
Well, first of all, I didn't learn about it in school. I got a pretty low quality education. In elementary school. But I have learned now that the English exported all of the food of Ireland to England, and the Irish were left only with potatoes. And then when the potatoes were running out, That was what caused the great migration of Irish people into the U.S. and other places, I'm sure. I know that like a little.
Well, in Australia,
as an Irish, you know, person of Irish ancestry.
Fascinating. Well, Australia is also full of a lot of Irish people. And in elementary school in Australia, I learned that there are Irish in Australia because of the Great Potato Blight that caused for the Great Potato Famine. Right. And I remember at the time thinking, did all they eat was potatoes?
It does make it sound like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But that was the story I was told. And so it was only as an adult that I learned that it was because the English had colonized Ireland. Yeah.
Because they had salmon and they had all kinds of food. But just to say, like, the idea of Irish people only eating potatoes is also like a smear on Irish people too, you know? I mean, not by you, but it's kind of interesting that the story, and this is often the case, reinforces a stereotype or, you know, diminishes the people to something kind of weird and foreign.
Yes.
On purpose, of course.
On purpose, yeah. And thank you for naming that, because part of the Irish stereotype in Australia growing up is, like, you know, it was a great potato blight. All they had was potatoes, and that Irish people are flaming mad and drunk all the time. Right. And no one explained that that was.
That's here too.
That's here too. Okay. But no one explained that that's the longitudinal aftermath of on purpose genocide through starvation and the denial of food.
Yeah. Just a perfect example, and there are millions of others, of course, of how the victim is made to be the problem.
Yes.
And whatever happened to them, they caused it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. They caused their own demise, and that is Darwinism in action. Yeah. And then Darwinism is then used to reinforce racial stereotypes and to justify the erasure of a people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when we demonize a people, their erasure seems natural.
It's a good excuse to genocide them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. 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 And it's not just the peoples, it's the entirety of the peoples, their way of being, their way of loving, their way of praying, their way of tending to the earth, their way of singing, the stories that they tell, the wisdom of their culture that has been passed on through generations, through relationships, through deep observation, through deep apprenticeship. Not just at the feet of elders, but at the feet of plants. Yeah, at the feet of the sunrise and the sunset and the way the insect symphony shifts throughout the day, throughout the month, throughout the year. Right? This secure attachment to time is beyond the clock and beyond hustle culture. I mean, clocks were used to measure time and then to measure productivity. Which and then we have a culture where productivity equals self-worth, and then I'm hustling against time. And our time clocks used to be based on something very different. The return of the salmon, the return of the caribou. The
bison.
The return of the bison, the rising of an orange sun that only comes at a certain time of the year. Mm. Yeah.
Feels like in our bones, we know this.
Yes. Yes. And also with this can come a lot of grief for what we have lost, for what was taken that shouldn't have been taken, of what was given that shouldn't have been given and what we gave away in order to survive. Yeah. And yet this deep kinship with ancestors, right? If I go through those, that conceptualization again, right? It's more than our human ancestors. Right? We have ancestors of more than human kin who coexisted alongside our human ancestors, who pre-existed our human ancestors. And we have ancestors who are more than our bloodline ancestors. We have professional ancestors and spiritual ancestors and professional and activist ancestors, right? Whose strength and wisdom we can draw upon. We have ancestors seen and unseen, ones who we're aware of and ones who are waiting for us to meet them and greet them and welcome them. And this secure attachment with nature. And ancestors, they share with us how to take care of ourselves and the world around us. And they do this through words and also through showing, through being, but also through songs and stories and art and music. Yeah. And secure attachment with culture, language, food. Your gut biome is something worth looking into, right? Yeah.
You know, when you were saying about more than human ancestors, I did think about the bacteria in our gut. Because, like, some of those strains are literally have been around in the soil always, you know? And we're literally reliant upon those bacteria in our gut biome to exist. We literally can't live without them.
Yes. Yes. I, here in Alaska, I make caribou pho and moose pho and wild Ooh. Duck pho, right? I call it East meets redneck. And and for me, pho is womb juice. It's womb juice. It's what my mother nourished herself upon while I was inside of her, and it's what her mother nourished herself upon while I was inside of my mother inside of her, right? And this gut biome knows what soul food is, what womb juice is. Yeah. My partner said something really interesting to me once. He looked at me and he said, oh, you know, most Americans, and he's a white American, he said, most Americans eat to get the feeling of fullness. But how about we attune our bodies to eat so that we actually get the trace elements, the micronutrients and macronutrients that our body actually needs?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also want to name that food can be a sensitive issue for many folks who may be listening. So, yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, you know, culture. Culture is the glue of the ancient technology of how to be in relationship with each other and with the world around us. And rituals, which mark rites of passage, which mark the passage of a human over the course of a lifespan within a village setting, rituals comprise of song, story, movement, and silence. And we have lost our rituals. We celebrate the Day of the Dead at Walmart, right? Like, that's where we get our Day of the Dead stuff.
Probably starting in September, too.
without the relationship to the dead and partying with the dead.
The extractive culture where we can commodify just the cute part or the cool part, as someone decides it to be, of deeply meaningful cultural rite or ritual, which is so violent.
And we become hollowed out and more shallow in the process. And it's hard because some of us don't know what we didn't get. And also for some of us, our own cultures have harmed us, or our parents have harmed us, and we've conflated our parents with their culture and unable to distinguish between the two. Yeah, for a long time, as an example, for a long time I got away from Vietnamese culture because no one ever told me that every single Vietnamese adult I knew was traumatized. And so I conflated trauma with culture.
That makes sense. Now, who would tell you? Because most of the traumatized people aren't aware of being traumatized.
No. Yeah. Yeah. And so it took me some time to come to reclaim culture and work through a lot in that process of reclamation. To work through internalized white supremacy, to work through adjacency and proximity to whiteness and to maleness and to status and to importance. Yeah, to work through internalized shame around my food smelling bad, right? Internalized shame and humiliation around bullying. Yeah, right. And so this too can be fraught. And it's worth it, right, to find your people with whom you can move through whatever emerges in your process of reclamation. Yeah. And not all of it will grok with you, and that's okay. I tried listening to traditional Vietnamese music, and I'm like, nah.
Not your thing.
Not my thing. But I looked up Vietnamese heavy metal, and I was really amazed. Oh yeah, there are some awesome battle hymns of Vietnamese victory over the invading Mongol armies.
All right.
Yeah, and I got to learn some more of my own history, and it was through a
song.
Through song, yeah.
Not in the way that we think of it in like folklore, you know, being transmitted through song, but nevertheless, it's a cultural transmission.
Yes. And so here's the thing with intergenerational trauma and with mass historical trauma and with mass historical collective trauma, right? What happens is with that displacement, as well as with the vilification, demonization, shaming of our foods, our languages, our cultural practices, there then is a cultural void. And within that void, that's where whiteness, can then take its grip and take its foothold. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Seductively calling, blend in here. We're all the same. It's okay.
Come and trick or treat.
Bland. We're very bland. Don't worry about it. Come trick or treat.
Come trick or treat. And then let's see. We talked about time really briefly earlier, and then secure attachment relationship to bodies, to my body, to the communal body, right, which is secure attachment to play, to pleasure, to rest, which then puts work in its right place. And yet so many of us needed to objectify our own bodies and reduce our bodies to being objects of service, factors of capital for production in order to produce profit for ourselves or for someone else. And so there is much reclamation in play and rest and pleasure. There's much reclamation in connecting to our sensorialness and walking through a forest and rubbing leaves and moss against our faces and to feel the temperature and the wetness, to smell.
The fecundity. Smell
the fecundity. Yes, to smell the fecundity of the way dew smells when intermingled with forest pine and moss. Yeah.
As we're listening, those who are listening to this, your system, like your body, it knows what Linda's talking about, you know? Even if you don't live near a forest.
No, but Anne, we each have an ecology that, look, okay, there is a land somewhere that misses you. Yeah. There is a land somewhere that misses you. And it might be inklings or urgings or tuggings at the edges of your awareness. Or maybe it's front and center, you know. Yeah, you know, to go on a pilgrimage at some point. And it doesn't have to make any sense. And yet there's a deep, 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 deep nourishment and nurturance when we engage in reclaiming the fullness of what it means to be human. Because then we know our place. And then we can engage in a skillful relationship and a right relationship with this web of life. And it's one of those foundational, fundamental truths that we are inextricably, inescapably intertwined, whether we like it or not. And we cannot escape the consequences of our actions or each other's actions.
Yep.
And we need to learn to metabolize, to alchemize, to be responsible. We are so immature, and it's okay. And it's not okay.
Yeah.
Right.
It's kind of okay. Is it? You used a word that I can't recall, or a phrase. It's not polarity, dynamic polarities. Yeah. You know, you're describing, and you have beautiful language to describe something that's so visceral and very hard to grasp. So I'm incredibly grateful to you for, one, your brilliant mind, but your ability to translate what's in there in a way that makes sense to understand and give some comfort. That there's like a way of looking at what's going on. And then there's a way of staying humane within this time that we're living in.
I think there's a call for us to come home, to find home, to find our place. And the word human is derived from that hum, that hum, H-U-M, which also has similar proximity to the words humility and humiliation. Yeah, it's to be small, to know our place amongst the vastness of things, and yet it can be weaponized, right? Humiliation is to make someone small. Humility is to know your insignificance in such a way that there's an expansiveness. Yeah. And human also, that hum is that humus layer, that fecund layer right at the top of the surface that's hot, with decay. Composting. And so may we learn how to compost.
It's an invitation.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Linda, I know that there are so many people listening who are, maybe they didn't know about you before, or maybe they did, but they want to learn more from you as they hear everything you share in our conversation today.
I have a website. It's linda-tai.com. linda-tai.com. There's a course coming up, The Missing Pieces of Attachment Theory, right? A Decolonized Approach. And it's 6 weeks. We do a little bit every week based on each of these portals of expanded reclamation of what it means to be fully human. The first week is the frame, the setup. And I break it down in bits and pieces. There are practices. There's pods that we can get you connected to if you're someone who wants to be connected with folks closer to you, or folks who hold similar identities to you. And we're all, you know, and it's an expansive group because there are folks in the group who've worked with their secure attachment template and it's great, but, and something more is needed. Like they're aware that there's something more.
Yeah.
And this act of reclamation, it can be reparative and it can also create nourishment and sustenance so that we can, work towards the changes that we would love to see for ourselves and for this planet.
Yeah.
And in order to do the long haul work of liberation, interspecies liberation, this requires us to reckon with the relentlessness of compassion fatigue, vicarious trauma, burnout, and we need more nourishment and more sustenance and more community.
Oh, yes, we do. And this is a way that not only can people learn together from you, but then they can learn how to take these practices and go out and use them in their lives beyond the course and create more of this community and nourishment and sustenance.
I think this will be the third time that I've taught this course, and I am always delighted and astounded when I get emails from people sharing with me how they've applied these practices into their lives and what has shifted for them. Yeah. At the very individual level, at the family level, at the community level. Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
You put so much into everything you create and it comes through into such a beautiful program or presentation or whatever it turns out to be. So I know that people will benefit from your course and they can find it on your website. So you have one coming up that starts in June 2026.
Yes, it starts June 25, 2026. Okay. Yes.
And so for anyone who's listening after summer 2026, they can go to your website and find what else you're doing. And maybe next time you offer this.
You could also purchase recordings for that course.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And I'm in the process of getting it CE approved.
That's going to be even better.
So you can get a head start on the next round of CEs with a course that starts on June 25.
And you only have to show up for a short period of time every six weeks.
Yes. Yes, you turn up live, you fill in the, you know how CEs work. And with the recordings, you can also get, I'm working to get CEs for the recordings. However, NBCC councillors cannot get CEs for watching recordings currently.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm. I learned something new a few weeks ago. Mm.
Well, that's a small drawback, but.
Yeah. Just come and attend live.
You know, there's benefit to learning, even if you can't use the CEs for re-credentialing. And I don't know, but I think based on the years I've known you, you tend to price your offerings at a very fair rate.
Yes. We've had to bump them up a bit because the mental health continuing education industrial complex is challenging to navigate.
Yes,
so for CEs, we've had to bump up the pricing, and I'm also very generous with BIPOC discounts, with discounts for folks who are in situations where paying full price isn't accessible. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I know that you really care about that.
Yes, and I also have a per country pricing list too. So if you live in Egypt, then there's a different price for you.
Okay.
Yeah, and so it's just to recognize and do my small part in the ways that I can in regards to the disequilibrium of resource allocation in this world.
Beautiful. Well, Linda, thank you so much for everything you do.
And thank you, Laura.
Well, you're welcome. And for being my guest here on Therapy Chat. And for sharing your beautiful wisdom with our listeners and with me.
You're so welcome.
Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Thank you for listening to Therapy Chat with your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC. For more information, please visit therapychatpodcast.com.